Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You know how you always want to know about everyone else's money? Well, then listen to What We Spend. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Caps Canadians game one tonight down at Capital One Arena. A busy sports week on the sports calendar always with the NBA and NHL playoffs going on. And then the NFL draft at the end of the week, Thursday night. We'll have all-day coverage, all-night coverage right here on the Team 980. And the Caps don't play Thursday night, right, Grant? It's a Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule, so no conflict with the first round of the NFL draft. We'll talk some draft, but as all of you know, Grant hosts with Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan, 2 to 6.30 every day. You can follow Grant on X on Twitter, at Grant Paulson. Is there pressure on this team to go deep into this postseason after 7 years of nothing following the cup?
Kevin, I think there's immense pressure on this team to get out of the first round because not only have they not gone deep, they have not gotten out of round one since the 2018 Stanley right. Cup. And there are reasons for that that are explanations as much as excuses. They've had some pretty serious injuries. They were in a great spot in a series against Carolina the following year, and T.J. Oshie on a pretty ugly hit by Warren Fogle was lost, and it changed the series. They had the COVID year where, you know, it was kind of a crapshoot, and you're playing in a neutral site. It didn't matter as much. But here's the thing. It doesn't matter when you look at a seven-year sample and you go, you've been one of the better teams in hockey. They've made the playoffs 10 out of 11 years. And you got really nothing to show for it other than the cup run in terms of getting to even an Eastern Conference final. So I think if they got to round two with all their injuries, played a competitive series, you could probably project ahead and say they're in a really good spot moving forward. But if they were to get bounced in a 1-8 matchup in round one by Montreal, it would be a really bad look.
Why do odds makers not give them much of a chance? They're the third or fourth odds choice in the Eastern Conference, like the seventh or eighth overall to win the cup when they had the second best record in hockey.
So it's a good question. The easy answer would be they played terribly down the stretch, and they, as they were kind of hunting Ovi's record and the win losses, didn't go the way they wanted in the last 2 weeks. Didn't look like a playoff team necessarily. They kind of took their foot off the gas pedal. But I don't think that's true because you monitor those odds like I do.
Yeah, it's been that way for a while.
Exactly. When they were the best team in the East, yeah. When they were running away and hiding with the Metro, the one seed in the East, and competing for the President's Trophy as the number one team in the National Hockey League, they were still there. So it's a great question. I think recency effect in the postseason is a factor. There's a little bit of, you know, show me. I think that they're demanding of the Capitals. The market's established for a reason. I think the narrative nationally is that they are a bit of a regular season tiger, right? And they've got to prove themselves in the playoffs. But the last thing I'll say is, and again, this is maybe not reflective of the odds changing, but I think if they were fully healthy, it would look different. They're without their top goaltender in game one, very likely Logan Thompson. They're going to be without a top line forward, and this is their biggest loss to me by far, Alexi Protas, who was their best player at even strength. Until late in this series at the earliest, he might play if it goes six or seven, but he probably won't be around until round two. And then the news I'm hearing on Marty Ferravari, a top four defenseman, is actually bad. I mean, it does not sound like he's playing in this series. Nobody said that definitively, but it could be a while before we see him, even if they go on a run, if we see him again. So they're not healthy. And for a team that was healthy all year, that's a bummer. But I do think that gets reflected in the odds a little bit.
Isn't some of it just that some of the teams in the East, like Tampa and Florida and Carolina and Toronto, are really good?
Sure, absolutely. They are very good. I mean, the Caps were better this year, and maybe you could make the case again that those teams played a better brand of hockey going into the playoffs. But when Washington was rolling, the odds still didn't reflect that. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's odd because for so many years you could say, Kevin, with a Capitals style of play when they were young and fast and getting up and down the ice, they didn't score a lot of dirty goals. Maybe they weren't elite defensively. You could say they didn't really play the playoff brand of hockey. For basketball fans, it was like the Phoenix Suns back in the day that would win 60 games.
Yeah.
But then you get them in these half-court situations, just like Houston right now. You know, you need the Rockets to play these games down the stretch and 2 minutes left, and they got to go get buckets in half court. It's a tough ask. But the Caps this year do those things. I actually think they're built, if healthy, well for the playoffs. They get the dirty goals. They get a lot of traffic. They are big and physical and heavy. They are faster than they've been. And they were top five scoring goals and allowing goals. They've been excellent defensively up until the final couple of weeks as well.
Logan Thompson was the first off the ice with in this morning's skate around. So you think that means he probably doesn't go in game one? And if that's true, what's the difference between him and Lindgren?
So typically that would mean that he would be the guy. And it is very possible. Like, I would not be shocked if he played. But Lindgren has been the starter down the stretch while Thompson was hurt. He has not played in a game in weeks. He is healthy and close to 100%, it sounds like, based on what people that were at practice saw and told me this weekend. But the plan, as it was kind of passed along to me in a game of telephone here recently, was more likely that Lindgren would get the assignment in game one. They'd kind of see how that went, and then Thompson would be available into game two. Now, if he's just 100%, he's their best goalie, and he should start. And maybe that is going to be the case. Again, I wouldn't be shocked. I've just leaned Lindgren because he had one very good start to end the season. They finally got him where they wanted him to be going into the playoffs. The difference to answer that question, Kevin, is Thompson's much more trustworthy. You know, they stockpiled their wins with him in net. When he was at his best this season, you know, going back to the winter, he was the second-best goaltender in hockey outside of Connor Hellebuck, who was going to win the Vezina Award as the best at the position. And Thompson has been a part of a team that made a cup run in Vegas. I mean, this is an outstanding postseason caliber netminder. Lindgren's a fan favorite. He's great in the room. He had an outstanding year last year. And, you know, he carried them to the playoffs as a nearly minus 40 goal differential team as the eighth seed when he got hot. But he has not played at that level this year. And I would say there's a sizable difference between the two. I don't know that all the reporters that cover the team would agree, but my opinion is Thompson at his best is considerably better than Lindgren. He's rebound control, just more confident, and in the cage, I think, gives them a much better chance to go on a run. I think you could win a series with Lindgren. I think you could go many rounds with Logan Thompson.
Talking to my guy Grant Paulson from, of course, 106.7 The Fan. So what are you confident in entering this series, and what concerns you? The injuries, like, are the biggest concern.
Yeah, you know, everyone's been talking about how they're playing, and I could be wrong. You know, this is hockey so quirky and weird. It's about puck luck and bounces, and I just view it different than other sports. I don't necessarily believe in momentum mattering or not. Edmonton got waxed 7-0 in one of their final games of the season last year and then went on a cup run. I worry more about the injuries, and I think people are so busy talking about how they played that they're not talking about when you don't have your best even strength player on the top line, it's a big deal. You know, when you don't have a top four defenseman, Marty Ferravari, and I just don't know that people realize how hurt he is at this point, because that's like the third injury people talk about. It happened at the very end of the season. It's a big deal. And so those injuries are number one. I would say if we're just moving past that, like, you got to line up and play hockey. My biggest concern would be the top line for Montreal, Cole Caulfield and Nick Suzuki, their leading point getter and their top offensive players. I think you can make the case that was one of the best lines in the National Hockey League over the last 3 or 4 weeks. They can skate around. They can put up points and goals. I think they're going to get their chances, especially with the Caps being a little bit banged up on the back end defensively with that third pair. What I feel great about is two of the four lines for Washington that haven't been touched injury-wise. Their second line That's Pierre-Luc Dubois, Tom Wilson, and Connor McMichael, which was the strength of their team in the first half of the season back together now. I think those guys will be excellent, and I hope they put that PLD line, which is their best defensive line. He's one of the better two-way players in hockey, you know, on that Suzuki-Caulfield line that I just mentioned. And I feel really good about their fourth line having a big series. That's the Nick Doubt-centered line with Brandon Duhaime on the back end. They're moving Taylor Radish back down. I think you got to get production out of Anthony Beauvillier, who's going to be on the top line with Alex Ovechkin and Dylan Strome. He's filling in for Protas. And that third line, Kev, so that's Ryan Leonard, the rookie you've heard so much about from Boston College, centered by Lars Eller, who helped win them a cup years ago, has left and come back, but just really hasn't played at a high level. I'd say he's one of their weakest links this year. That line with Andrew Mangiapane, who makes $5.5 million, was okay, but probably didn't live up to the money. One of the few off-season additions that wasn't an A+, it was probably more like a B- or a C. That's going to be maybe the story of the series. Can they get anything out of Leonard, Eller, and Mangiapane? But I feel great about what they call lines 2 and 4, and I think it's their best two most consistent lines.
All right, one quick question about Montreal beyond what you've said. What about their goaltender, Mont Tremblant? That's not his name, but that's the beautiful place in Montreal. I can't say his last name. But people have said, in doing some very light reading on it, that this guy is capable of carrying them. Is that true?
Yes, he is. I mean, Samuel Montembeau. He is, I would say, at his best, scary. Like, he's a guy that we could be punching walls saying, man, he's stealing games. But here's the problem. So I think he finished like 23rd in save percentage, Kev, or something like that in the National Hockey League. They gave up top five shots allowed. They are leaky defensively. This is not a good defensive team. So if the Caps do win the series, I think it's going to be them scoring 4 and 5 goals at a time. The goalie isn't necessarily the problem as much as their defensive end of the ice, where they give up a ton of shots. They should be able to get a lot of pucks on the net.
You like them easily or not? Long series, short series?
I like them. I would take them in 5 if they were healthy. I think it's probably going to be 6, maybe even 7, just because they're so banged up.
And then who in the East do you think they can't beat? Is there anybody that they can't beat?
I don't like them matching up with Florida. And in the second round, they'll probably get Carolina, unless the Devils come back to win that series. I think they could beat Carolina, but I think it could be a bad matchup if they have to go 7 and deal with Montreal and they take a chunk of skin out with a bite or two as they go.
All right, we'll shift gears here because we do have the draft coming up at the end of the week. What do you hope they do? You and Danny, I'm sure, have talked about, you know, possibilities at 29, what you'd like to see, what you wouldn't like to see. Give me both of those. What do you hope falls to them at 29 and they execute on? And what do you hope they steer clear of?
Yeah, so I would trade back as best I could. Now, it's easy to say that. I think a lot of teams in the back end of the first round want to do that. It's easier said than done. But I think more than maybe I've ever wanted them to in the past, based on the lack of quantity of picks and where they're at on the board, I think trading back would actually make more sense this year than I can remember. But let's just say hypothetically they can't. You know, I think you got to pick an edge if one falls. Now, I don't know what you're hearing or what guests are telling you, but I was a big fan of like Donovan Esaraku from Boston College, Mike Green. These two guys are probably both gone, it looks like. I mean, it sounds like there could be 5 or 6 edges that go in the top 25, 27 picks. So as much as I've been desperate for them to get a pass rusher, and I've screamed into a megaphone for a month, that's what I want them to do, you can't reach. Like, I wouldn't take James Pierce probably at 29. So if Esaraku or Green is there, which I think is increasingly less likely, I would be giddy to take one of those players. Otherwise, if you can't trade back, I think I go corner, because there's going to be some value there. It feels like how the board's supposedly going to go according to all the mock drafts. And I'll never be upset with a weapon, Kev. I want a running back who can hit a home run, a wide receiver who could take a first down and make it a touchdown. You know, it took them almost half the season last year to get a touchdown from a receiver who, like, caught a ball in the grass and went into the paint with it. They need playmakers. So I'm never going to be upset doing that.
Yeah, I think Green doesn't make it anywhere near Washington. And if he does, then the red flags on him are, you know, worth paying attention to. And Ezeraku, there's a chance. There's a chance, but you might be right. His pass rushing ability might mean he's beyond that, or he goes before 29 overall. By the way, I was sitting here looking at your Twitter, because you wrote something over the weekend, changing subjects again, about the Nats. I didn't know this. You were watching the game. I wasn't. But this is the second time I think this has happened, and I'm curious as to why you think it's happened. But you tweeted out, if James Wood isn't hurt and Davey pulled him in the seventh with this bullpen in a game in Colorado, that's just bad. Sorry, save the there's a doubleheader tomorrow response. Don't care. Stop pulling your best player. He did this in the Dodger game when they had a lead,
yep.
But it was the Dodgers and the heart of the order was coming up, and they pulled yep. him for defensive purposes, and he was due up second in the bottom of the ninth. I actually asked, I think I asked Zuckerman, and I think I asked Tommy, isn't that a big deal? Why would he do that? He's their biggest threat. And they said, well, defensively, they had a lead. So you feel the same way, that it doesn't make any sense to pull him. Well, spell out the game situation in that moment when he pulled him.
Yeah, Kevin, it's egregious. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how someone could argue opposite, because it's not like they're putting Andrew Jones in defensively. They're putting in Alex Cole. Me he's a little bit better than James Wood? Maybe. Like on a 20-80, maybe he's a 50, 55. Wood's a 45, 50, whatever. But it's not that different. And you referenced the Dodgers game. The problem that was so annoying about that was, as you said, he was due up second, and I think it was a one. At most, it was a two-run game.
It was a two-run game. It was 6-4.
Yeah, with the worst bullpen in the sport, and the Dodgers, as you said, heart of the order coming up. So if you would have gotten back to the point where you need Wood to hit now bottom nine and it's a call, that's malpractice. But in this specific situation over the weekend, it was the seventh inning, and yes, they were up huge. So you could say, well, it was 12-2. If anybody's ever seen a game at Coors Field, there's more six-run innings in that ballpark than there is anywhere in the sport. And with this bullpen, if you want to do that maybe in the eighth or the ninth, I suppose I get it. But I don't like it, period. Again, you're not upgrading substantially defensively. James Wood's being treated as if he's some liability in left.
Which is he? That's my question to you. How bad is he defensively?
When he got called up last year in left field, which he had barely played, he was bad. He was not reading things well. It looked bad. And if you wanted to pull him out of games then, I guess you could have. He has made major adjustments. This was a guy that played center field in the minor leagues. He is a great athlete. He should ultimately be an above-average defender. I don't think he is one yet. But again, if I'm saying, like, at best, if you want to say he's a 5.5 out of 10, Alex Cole's not better than a 6. By the way, Cole came in, misplayed a ball with the bases loaded, and 3 runs scored because it got all the way to the wall. But there's a larger point, too, where if I were to concede that, let's say, he's a bad defender, which I don't agree with, what teams pull their best players regularly? Who does that? I mean, just from a relationship-building standpoint, just from a young star, they're giving the kids bobblehead away on Tuesday and Wednesday, the face of the whole damn thing. What team is pulling their best player a few times a week defensively? It doesn't happen. And he is not an albatross. That's my frustration. It's not like he's standing out there with a pot or a pan on his hand. I just don't get it.
Yeah, that Dodgers game, I remember thinking, that doesn't make any sense with the heart of the order coming up in him. It's the Dodgers. Your bullpen sucks. You almost have to assume that it's going to be tied or you're going to be behind in the ninth inning. Now, if it was 12-2, I don't think, I mean, you said it in the moment. It looks like you tweeted it out in the moment. I would not have thought of that at 12-2, even in Coors Field. But still,
well,
he
only
had
because it was the seventh inning, right? Like, that's, you're talking about essentially the middle of the ball game. Like, yeah, had he done it in the ninth, I would not have even been bothered. Certainly not tweeted. But it's the third time this season he's done it. So to me, there's this philosophy as if they need to get him out of the game defensively. And everyone's like, well, they have a doubleheader tomorrow. A, he's 22. B, they were off on Friday. C, they're going to be off on Monday. Like, this is not about rest. He's fine. They clearly think that they need to play Alex Cole. Why don't they do that with C.J. Abrams at shortstop? With Nassim Nunez, who's an elite defender. Why don't they do that? They haven't done it once with Ahmed Rosario at third base. I don't understand it.
Yeah. By the way, and looking at the box score, when they took him out, he was 3 for 5 with 4 RBIs and a 3-run homer. And in that game, how about Dylan Cruz? Good for him. 2 homers in that game in that 12-11 win on Saturday.
Man, did he need it. He's been struggling. Yeah. He didn't have an extra base hit, Kev, until that game. And then he hit 2 homers, and those were not like cheapy Colorado homers. I mean, opposite field, right center. And he hit a double as well. He's got a 6-game hitting streak, so he's finally getting it going.
All right. You guys are where today? City Tap House, Penn Quarter. You and Danny doing the show there, right?
Yeah, we're fired up. We're actually going to be giving away Caps tickets on site for people coming through for later in the series. But, yeah, it's 2 blocks from the arena.
Yep.
So if anybody's going down to the game, they got great Cap specials, and people will be rocking their red. All the bartenders wear Cap sweaters, so it's going to be a good atmosphere.
901 9th Street Northwest, literally a block and a half, 2 blocks from the arena. Go down and see Grant and Danny. Thanks for doing this. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, my pleasure, Kev. Be good, man.
Yep. Grant Paulson, everybody. When we come back, Sam Monson from the 33rd team. We'll talk NFL draft with Sam. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. And was one of the original guys at Pro Football Focus. He left about a year ago to go to the 33rd team. I've always enjoyed Sam's football analysis, and I had him on my podcast over the weekend, and I wanted to play a lot of it back. Now, I started by asking him about the possibility that Trey Hendrickson gets dealt before the draft or maybe on draft day. Here's what he said.
I don't, because I think the Bengals still desperately need him. You know, they tried to sort of future-proof that position a couple of years ago with drafting Miles Murphy in the first round. That hasn't worked out. And if they didn't have Trey Hendrickson on last year's defense, you know, it would be one of the worst defenses the game has ever seen, even with him playing at an all-pro kind of level. It was a terrible defense. So I think they need to keep him around. I think there's a deal to be done that makes everybody happy, even with the contracts they've already handed out. So my gut reaction is they still figure out a way of making it work.
All right, let's talk draft. Travis Hunter is the best player in an NFL draft since who?
I think it's hard to quantify how good he is, because what makes him special is unique. He wouldn't be the best wide receiver in last year's draft. He wouldn't be the best cornerback in a lot of drafts. But the fact that he's in the conversation for both at the same time is, I mean, it's not quite unprecedented, but you have to go back to like the 60s when players were two-way players regularly. You know, since the NFL went to multiple sides of the ball, everybody playing one side, we really haven't seen a player like Travis Hunter come along. Guys have come along who have dabbled with both, you know, played a little bit on one side of the ball while playing predominantly on the other. You know, Champ Bailey or Charles Woodson or Chris Gamble, like, that's happened before. But we haven't seen a guy that's been an every down starter on both sides of the ball and arguably a top five player in the nation at both of them at the same time. It's completely ridiculous. It's basically unprecedented in the modern era, and that's what makes him great. And a big part of that question is, how sustainable is that in the NFL? I mean, it shouldn't have been sustainable in college, so he's already breaking new ground. But we don't know yet what this is going to look like in the NFL. You know, all those other guys that dabbled with it in college were fairly well shut down in the NFL and just turned into, you know, one side of the ball players. You know, maybe they would get a couple of snaps here or there on the other side of the ball, but effectively they became just a specialist on one side of the ball. It sounds like the NFL is going to give Travis Hunter a legitimate shot to play both ways in some capacity. And that unknown, the level of the sum capacity, I think is what determines how great he can be. If he's able to do something approaching what he was doing in college in the NFL, it would make him one of the greatest players in the game. If he becomes, you know, a player that basically plays almost all of the snaps on one side of the ball and then a handful of plays on the other side, it's still valuable, it's still incredibly impressive, but I think it's a lot less, you know, generational and sort of awe-inspiring than the potential of what he could do if he was allowed to do what he did in college.
Well, what should he focus on at the NFL level? Which side of the ball?
It's tough because, look, it depends what the goal is, right? If he wants to maximize his potential, I think wide receiver earns more money than cornerback. That's just a reality. I think he's a better wide receiver than he is a cornerback. So everything would be pushing you towards playing receiver first and figuring out corner second. But, you know, there are teams that have the greater need at corner. And I think it's easier to, if you're going to play him two ways to some degree, it's a much easier balancing act to have him as a full-time corner and then put him in there for some snaps on offense than it is the other way around, where, you know, teams very, very rarely have a defensive back on a sort of pure pitch count. You know, there you have sub-package corners, nickel backs, dime corners, those types of things. But the problem with that is if you're kind of at the mercy of what the offense does then. If you just had Travis Hunter as your nickel corner, I mean, you can be trapped in nickel for the entire game if a team wants to do that by just putting out, you know, the correct person on offense to put you in that situation. So you're not necessarily in control of the snaps he's playing as easily in terms of if he's playing defense. So if it was me, I would have him as a full-time wide receiver and then try and figure out what the best way of using him on defense is. But I think that's where he's at his best.
Who's the best quarterback in this draft, and where would he have been taken in last year's draft?
I think it's Cam Ward, definitely. I think he's got the easiest tool set to sell yourself on. He's got all the physical ability. He's got some incredible throws on his tape. You know, he's a little bit of a big game hunter, a bit of a maverick, a bit of a gunslinger, all those cliches, and that can be a little bit scary. But I think he would be up in the conversation with the sort of second tier of the top six last year. I mean, so many quarterbacks went, and they all went early. But even with that group, it felt like there was a fairly strong consensus that it was the top three, Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, and Drake May, and then the next three, J.J. McCarthy, Bo Nix, and Michael Penix Jr. sort of came out of nowhere to be in that group as well. I think he belongs in that second group somewhere. And obviously those guys ended up getting squeezed much tighter together than people thought they would. But I think he would be in that collection of quarterbacks a year ago.
Where does Shedeur Sanders go?
That's the big X factor in this draft. You know, you can make a case that he should still go two or three to one of the two really quarterback needy teams in Cleveland and the Giants, even with the sort of veteran additions that they've made. But if he doesn't, and if teams do think that, you know, there's not enough sort of physical special tools there and he starts sliding, there aren't that many teams that it makes sense to halt that slide for a while. You know, the Saints, obviously, at nine are the obvious ones. The Steelers that we talked about, if Rodgers doesn't sign with them, might be forced into doing it. And if either one of those teams thinks a different quarterback is QB2 in this draft, I mean, Sanders could seriously slide.
On the running back conversation, how many go in the first round? And what's your philosophy now on running backs in the first round?
My hunch is probably two. I could just about see three, but I can't see any more than that. I think something like the answer is probably somewhere between one and two. I think ultimately, if you think the guy is special, I have no problem with drafting a running back in the first round. If you don't think he's special, particularly in this year, I think it makes all the sense in the world to wait, because there's a lot of talented running backs that are going to be available on day two and even day three. The question to me is not so much would you take them in the first round. It's, number one, what is the opportunity cost? What are you leaving on the table to take the running back? And number two, how high can you draft him? And I think that's where, you know, I don't have a problem with taking a guy in the first round, but I think there is a level at which it doesn't make sense to take them. You know, a level up in the draft, a number at which point it doesn't make any sense to draft the guy, because immediately the contract in the top five is making him one of the best paid running backs in the NFL. And so much of the value of those guys is, you know, the surplus value based off how cheap the rookie contracts are.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. It's like, you know, Washington, I think, will take a running back in this draft, Sam. But unless they believe that Hampton or Travion Henderson is Saquon Barkley or Christian McCaffrey or Jahmyr Gibbs or Bijan Robinson, I think they should wait. I don't think that player should be selected in the first round. Like, you got to really feel like the impact is going to be Barkley-esque to take a running back in the first round.
Yeah, and the difference is, with some other positions, like running back, you can find great running backs all the way through the draft. I mean, look at Bucky Irving last year for the Buccaneers. You can't say that for a lot of other positions. it's not that there are none of them. You know, almost every position is spitting out some form of impressive NFL player at every round in the draft. But at certain positions, so like a huge proportion of the impact players come right at the sharp end of the draft. So when you're looking at these players and you're like, well, we've got a couple of needs, one of them's running back, you know, but the other position, you're much less likely to be able to come back in the third round and find a player that can come in and make an impact the way you can with running back. So I think that's the problem. And that's why you need to be convinced that the guy is special and a gap, you know, a significant gap between him and the other running backs in this draft. And I think you can definitely make that argument for Ashton Jeanty, who I think would probably go in the top 10 pick somewhere. I don't think you can really make the case for anybody else in this draft. Omarion Hampton from North Carolina is really good, but I'm not 100% convinced he's better than a couple of other running backs in this draft. So, you know, I don't think you make that decision. But if Jeanty's on the board, I think that's different because, you know, he looks like far and away the best running back in this draft.
Well, it sounds like we're on the same page as it relates to Hampton. I'm just curious, who are the other backs in the draft that you don't see much difference between Hampton and those guys? Who are those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hampton is the second best back in this class. I had him in at second in my rankings. But, you know, if you run an outside zone scheme, I think you could easily talk yourself into Caleb Johnson from Iowa being just as good as Omarion Hampton, if not better. Travion Henderson from Ohio State is a better pass protector, is potentially more explosive, and was a pretty good running back in his own right when he had the sort of bell cow workload at Ohio State before they brought in Quinshon Judkins. Judkins himself is a very similar sort of athletic prototype or profile to Omarion Hampton, and you could talk yourself into him making that kind of impact as well. So I just think there's a group of other running backs, once you get beyond Jeanty, that are very similarly lumped together. And, you know, if you're making that decision, do we take Hampton or do we wait around or two when one of these guys is going to be available, you know, you might end up getting the better player having waited.
The guy that I like, and I'm just curious as to what you think, but I've loved Damian Martinez since his Oregon State days. Would you put him into that group? Because if you could get him on day three, to me, that's better than taking Hampton in the first round. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely agree. I really like Damian Martinez, incredibly young as well, and has done it in multiple different schemes. And then Dylan Sampson from Tennessee as well, I think, is in that group. Very different body type and a different sort of running back style, much smaller, so he doesn't have the sort of giant physical NFL body type that you would love, but I think talent-wise is in that category as well. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think that's the reason why, you know, if Jeanty's off the table and I'm debating a running back, that's the reason why I'm waiting in the first round.
All right. The odds are, at least, you know, from the books, Washington will end up taking, you know, a defensive end slash edge in the first round. So if I tell you that it is an edge at 29, they don't move back, they don't move up, tell me who you think is there and who the right fit for Washington would be at 29 as an edge player.
I think projecting the edge class this year is really difficult.
Right.
Everyone agrees that Abdul Carter is edge one. And after that, it gets chaotic because every one of the next sort of five or six guys has got some kind of flaw or red flag or just something to be scared of. Whether it's sample size, whether it's, you know, off field, whether it's attitude, whether it's lack of production, every one of these guys got some reason that you wouldn't want to draft them or that you would be at least hesitant to pull that trigger. But it's a different thing for almost each guy. And I think that introduces an amazing amount of randomness because we've no idea what each team is going to think about each one of those red flags. So I think that group could go in almost any order and it could go in almost any sort of level of the first round, depending on how much or little teams care about those red flags. I think the guys with the best chances of being there by the time Washington pick, it wouldn't shock me if Michael Williams from Georgia slipped a little bit, just a sort of general, wasn't quite the athlete that people were expecting him to be, you know, is a little bit on that lack of production end of the spectrum as well. The selling point for those sort of lack of production guys is, yeah, but he's a special athlete and, you know, we'll put it together at the NFL level. But Williams actually isn't quite the level of special athlete. So suddenly I think that's just a harder sell for NFL teams. Donovan Azuraku, I could see being around there, and I think he's sort of underrated relative to these other guys. I would love that as a pick for Washington. He's got elite pass rushing sort of chops, pass rushing tool set. I think he can play against the run as well. I think that part of his game is a little bit underrated. So I think he could be there. And then depending on, I think James Pierce is a big X factor. He's got mid to high first round tape, but there's a lot of the sort of the swirl about him is it's off field in the kind of work ethic attitude world. You know, it's not necessarily legal trouble. It's not, you know, drugs. It's none of that stuff. It's like, you know, why was Tennessee not playing him every down? You know, there's a lot of sort of talk about that he didn't necessarily commit to it full time in a way that's above and beyond. You know, sometimes you hear that from scouts whenever a guy has like a hobby, you know, or enjoys basketball or something ridiculous. It's like, well, does he really love football? That's crazy. But it's stronger than that with Pierce. And I wonder how much that's going to scare some teams away. It wouldn't shock me if Pierce fell out of the first round entirely, but equally, if he's there, I mean, his tape justifies that selection.
Yeah, I talked about this in the open. He's one that I would be very surprised if they took for those reasons. I mean, this is a team last year that 7 of their 9 picks were team captains as they were trying to change their culture. So, you know, I like Azarenko. I just wonder whether or not he's ready to be an edge-setting defensive end against the run versus more of just a specialized pass rusher to begin with. And they got gashed, Sam, last year against the run, especially, you know, sort of C-gap and outside. They really struggled to set the edge. And I'm curious as to whether or not you think there's one guy, you know, in that first, early, second round area that is head and shoulders above the others as a run stopper.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two guys that are sort of billed as the physical freak shows, Shamar Stewart and Michael Williams, I think those are the two best run-setting edge defenders in that kind of area. You know, Shamar Stewart in particular, we can all debate what he can become as a pass rusher and how concerning the lack of production is. The one thing I think that's pretty not even up for debate is that guy is a dominant run defender. He's incredibly powerful. He is able to just explode through offensive tackles, drive them into the backfield. If you drafted him high and had, you know, no real interest in his pass rush, and you said, look, you're going to go out there, you're going to absolutely murder the run, and then when we get to a passing down, just bull rush through the tackle, I think you would have a productive player.
Cornerback, who would be there and who would be worth taking at 29?
Corner, I think you're going to be in a good area there, depending on what exact type of corner you're looking at. But I think that's where there's a group of guys that are going to be available at that kind of spot. And it's sort of which one teams are most enamored with, whether it's Trey Amos from Ole Miss, Azaria Thomas from Florida State, Maxwell Hairston from Kentucky, Siobhan Revell. You know, press man teams will love him as well. I think he's a potential possible first-round player. That whole group of corners, I think, are going to start coming off the board towards that end of the first round, into the top of the second round. I really like Amos. I think Azariah Thomas is a very good player as well. And then Hairston has got crazy potential because of all that speed and explosiveness he showed.
I noticed that you had Benjamin Morrison from Notre Dame ranked really high on something that you did recently. He's a team captain. He's one of those high character guys. Is 29 too early for him?
It kind of depends. He's a big X factor player because it's all going to come down to the medical history with him.
Right.
I think he's got first round tape. I think he's got first round character. He's the most technically sound cornerback, I think, in this entire draft. But he has multiple, not just hip injuries, but hip surgery in his history. And that, I mean, hip surgery for a cornerback is a pretty scary thing. So look, none of us are doctors, but that's what the evaluation is going to come down to. If your medical team signs off on him and says, look, these were two freak injuries. They're dealt with. He's recovered. He's good to go. And they're not going to recur. I think you could easily justify Benjamin Morrison being drafted at the bottom of the first round. I think he's got that ability. But if that's something you're scared of and you say, look, these are going to come back, or, you know, this is going to be a reason that he's not the player that he used to be. You know, his hips are going to be tighter. His fluidity of movement is not going to be what it was. You know, all these things. Then you're going to have to drop him. And you have to say, look, he's not the player that he was when we were evaluating this tape.
The two safeties that are projected potentially in the first round, Amanuori from South Carolina, Starks from Georgia. If I told you they took a safety, which one should we be most happy about?
Honestly, I think both of them are extremely good players, very different players. Starks, I think it works in more schemes than Amanuori does. He's the sort of pure free safety coverage specialist, makes incredible plays on the ball, you know, has an amazing fluidity of movement at the safety position that we sort of just touched on with Benjamin Morrison. But he's able to fly despite the time 40 times just when he's doing actual sort of functional movement things. You know, when you watched him do the drills at the combine, his tracking data, the miles per hour stuff, he was basically the fastest guy at every drill,
right,
regardless of what his straight line sprinting 40 track time is. Amanuori, I think, is a little bit more boom or bust. Obviously, an incredible physical specimen, absolutely blew up the combine in terms of measurements and speed and explosiveness. His tape, I think, is a little bit more inconsistent. Doesn't always play to those physical gifts, but I think both guys have clear first-round ability and would fit into that defense.
Two more for Sam Monson. Wide receiver at 29, you know, they've got Terry McLaurin. They added Debo in the offseason. They brought back Noah Brown. They schemed everybody open last year in the Kingsbury offense with Jaden. If it's a wide receiver at 29 and they're looking for, you know, somebody to really compliment Terry long-term, who is it?
Yeah, that's tough. I think that wide receiver class is kind of chaotic as well. You get beyond the first couple, and then we get into what's your flavor, what type of receiver you're looking for. I think Jaden Higgins from Iowa State would bring something different to that receiving core from the guys you just mentioned. He's got size, he's got length, he's got the ability to win inside and outside. He can be a true X wide receiver. Somebody like Luther Burden brings utterly ridiculous run after the catch ability. I mean, when the ball is in his hands, he reminds me of prime Odell Beckham Jr. back with the Giants. You know, just this incredible tackle breaking, you know, yards after the catch machine. But I think he can run some routes as well. I think he's being slept on a little bit because of the season he's coming off. You know, a guy like Jalen Knoll from the other Iowa State receiver, incredible sort of vertical deep speed from the slot and can operate horizontally as well. I think there's a lot of options for them that would make sense at that kind of spot.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up Luther Burden. He's been one of my favorite players all year long, one of my favorite players until, you know, they traded Jahan Dotson last year in part because he took plays off, you know, during the season leading up to it. He didn't play to the whistle. Quinn basically wants guys that'll dive on the floor for loose balls. And I love Luther Burden with the ball in his hands. I mean, I think he is, I mean, he's not Tariq Hill, but he is really dangerous that way. But I just wonder whether or not they're going to love the kid overall as, you know, kind of a grinder and a gym rat. That's kind of what this organization seems to be looking for.
Yeah, and that was kind of that has been a lot of what's swirling around Luther Burden.
Yeah.
You know, did he kind of not quit on his team, but did he take those plays off? Did he sort of grow frustrated and it manifests in a negative way last season when his production dropped off, when his quarterback was hurt, you know, all those types of things. That's a fine line, right? I mean, the Giants sat Malik Nabers down last year. We saw this on Hard Knocks, and they were like, look, how would you handle when the ball's not going your way, when things are not going well? And he's like, it would make me mad. And they thought that was a great thing, right? And then halfway through the season, it's like Malik Nabers is making noise
because
he's not getting the football. It's like, well, that can cut both ways, right? So, yeah, I think that's definitely the thing that teams are going to have to weigh when they are evaluating Luther Burden. But you put on 2023 Luther Burden tape, that guy's a top 10 player in the draft, right? So that's the type of talent we're talking about. And then it's like, well, how much do we ding the way he behaved when the situation went south?
Sam Monson, everybody, the 33rd team on X, on Twitter, at Sam Monson NFL. Always generous with your time. I really appreciate it. Hopefully we can do it again before the season starts. Thanks. Enjoy next week.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Yeah, Sam had a lot more to say. You can listen to that on my podcast from Friday's show. When we come back, the guy that has become one of my favorite players in the draft, and he would fill a need for Washington. That's next.
All right. Over the weekend, the Nats split their Easter doubleheader with the Colorado Rockies. James Wood went 0-for after being pulled in the seventh inning of Saturday's game for Alex Call. They have the day off today and will take on the O's tomorrow at Nats Park on 106.7 The Fan. In the NBA, Cooper Flagg has declared his for the NBA draft. The Wizards have a 14% chance at landing the top pick along with the Utah Jazz and Charlotte Hornets. The draft lottery is May 12th. College football, Nico Amaliava has announced he is officially transferring to UCLA. The deal is reportedly in the $1.5 million to $2 million range, where he was making $2.4 million at Tennessee. The Eagles have re-signed Cam Jurgens to a four-year, $68 million deal. The extension ties him to Philly through the 2029 season. And the Washington Capitals will take on Ivan Demidov and the Montreal Canadiens in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference first round. They're still a bit banged up, though. Alexei Protas is out with a cut from a skate on his foot. He has been skating in a non-contact jersey at the past few practices, and Spencer Carberry says he should play at some point during this series. Martin Fervari is questionable after turning his ankle against the New York Islanders. Jacob Chychrun will play after being struck in the face by a puck on Friday's practice. And Logan Thompson was the first off the ice at practice this morning. Spencer Carberry declined to name the starter in net for tonight. And that's what's trending.
Ben Standing coming up shortly. So I gave kind of my running back thoughts on the draft earlier in the show. Tomorrow I'm going to give you my edge rushers on the show, just the way I see them. There's a player, though, in watching a lot of the edge guys that I want to talk about real quickly that I remember watching in big games for Ohio State, and just – you go through everything and then you see what he's been as an athlete and as a teammate. JT Tuimoloau, the defensive end edge for Ohio State, number 44, might be my favorite defensive player in the draft. I'm not sure you'll find anybody that plays with a higher motor, intensity, urgency, competitive level. He has played his best football in the biggest games that Ohio State's had. The first game where he really made his name was as a sophomore in Happy Valley, big showdown with Penn State in late October. The dude had in the game two sacks, a forced fumble, and two interceptions in the game. Last year, during the playoff run to a national championship, in four playoff games, he had 6.5 sacks and a forced fumble in wins over Tennessee, Oregon, Texas, and then Notre Dame in the national championship game. He has high motor, 6'4", 265. He's got the size. He's got the length. He's got everything. I'm actually really surprised that he's not considered to be a lock first rounder. And I think part of it was he was the most double-teamed guy for Ohio State this year. He took a lot of double teams, a ton of chips all year long. Remember Nick Bosa? I'm not putting him in the Nick Bosa category, okay? Bosa, special top five kind of a guy. But Bosa, remember, same with Chase Young. They got doubled and tripled a lot towards the end of those seasons, and everybody's like, where's the production? JT Tuimoloau was double teamed and chipped and ended up with 6.5 sacks and a forced fumble over four playoff games. He is, in terms of motor, there's a couple of dudes like that, you know, on the defensive side, and I'll talk more about them tomorrow, but the kid from Arkansas, Landon Jackson, has that kind of a motor too. But he would, if they traded back and got him and Travion Henderson in the second round, yeah, that would be my dream Buckeye scenario for Washington. Ben Standing next.